Hello and welcome back to part two of our conversation with Tyler Brinkman on trauma theology. Make sure to look up the program notes as we'll have information in there about where you can find more to read and also help for dealing with trauma. Thanks so much for joining us. If you have questions, you can find out more at brewtheology.org, at brewtheology on Facebook and Instagram, and at brew_theology on X, formerly known as Twitter. If you have any questions, you can email us at Ryan or Janelle at brewtheology.org. So welcome to part two of our conversation. I hope you enjoy it.
Well, one thing you mentioned in the curriculum was the concept of triggers. So can you talk a little about how even in someone that's experiencing some of that healing, some of that post-traumatic growth, what are triggers? How do they show up and how do they function in the midst of this?
Sure. So, I mean, a trigger is basically just a kind of like a conditioned response. Most people probably have heard of Pavlov's dogs, where he would ring a bell at the same time he would give the dog some food, and, you know, after a while was able to see that the bell, even without the food, still makes the dog salivate as if food was actually there. A little more complicated, but it's essentially the same kind of thing. Our brains get used to whatever we've experienced before. So, you know what did it really well for thinking about triggers is The West Wing, which is a show back from 99 to 2006, I think. There's a character in the second season who he was shot previously, basically at the season one finale, but there's an episode where they really key into this idea, and I don't think that they use the word triggered, but it's Christmas time in the White House, and they have the music ensembles come and play for anybody in the lobby to hear the nice Christmas music. And throughout the episode, we see him start to spin more and more out of control because he's just flipping out. And at the end of it, you know, the psychiatrist who he's talking to finally says, like, this isn't going to make any sense, but in your head right now, music is the same thing as ambulance and police sirens. And so he's just hearing the loud Christmas music that people are enjoying. And in the back of his head, below his ability to consciously understand it, his brain is interpreting that noise as the same kind of noise he heard after he'd been shot. And so he'd been reliving the experience of getting shot day in and day out for weeks. And that's why he was freaking out.
Yeah.
And that episode came out in 2001. So that was pretty early for, you know, kind of a real popular media take on PTSD and triggers and all that, but they did it so well. So that would be kind of an example. And so it's basically just our brain to be like, wait, what? I remember that. And this is a line that I got from, he's a renowned trauma researcher, thinker, writer, Bessel van der Kolk. But he said, all trauma is pre-verbal. All trauma happens below our ability to put into words, put into language. And I say that as someone who adores language. There's simply some things that can't be neatly expressed. And so even if someone has gone through some measure of healing, some of those can still be there and surprise us when they pop up in interesting ways.
I'm going to quote you here because you've got some good words. And you've talked about this already. If you want to elaborate, you can. But you say that trauma is always embodied. There is no disembodied trauma. It occurs when our body's abilities to integrate physical sensations, emotions, hormonal stress response, and memories are overwhelmed. While trauma is always embodied, its impact often comes in the forms of depersonalization, disembodiment, and disassociation. I know we've obviously been talking about this embodied state. This is critical to this understanding of trauma theology. Do you want to say anything more about this? I know we've kind of dealt with some of the practical things.
Yeah.
Reconnecting our bodies.
Yeah, so this is tricky for me because I was always a person who felt comfortable with words. You know, I just said that I love language. You were kind enough to say that, you know, I have some nice words, which I thank you for. Give me words, give me thoughts, and I'm very comfortable. My interest in embodiment came through intellectual curiosity, which is probably not the way most people go about it. As I was going through seminary and I kept writing on the importance of embodiment, of, you know, this is what it means to be a person, is to have a body or not just a mind and a meat suit. I am my body. And be like, oh, I'm going to get into this argument and engage these sources, be really great. Importance of embodiment. Yes. I kept writing paper after paper because it was of interest to me. And after a while, I'm like, okay, you keep writing papers and that's great, but like, you don't really use your body. You don't really do anything with it other than sit around and talk. And so it occurred to me after a while, I'm like, I keep like writing about this, but I'm not doing it myself. And so I had to kind of push myself to imagine different ways of, well, what is it? What would it mean for me to become more friendly with my body? Not that I like hate it. It's just always like, eh, it's not of interest. It's not like who cares? It's all unimportant. Like, just give me ideas because that's a place of comfort, but that's not a place of growth. A few years ago, I was seeing a therapist and pretty constantly she'd be like, okay, well, how are you feeling? And I'd be like, oh, I'm thinking. And I would explain my feelings rather than feel my feelings. Yeah. And trauma is one of the reasons for that, I think. It also makes a difference, for what it's worth, that I also have since had my own, and I'm almost assuredly on the autism spectrum. And so that kind of neurodivergency also probably plays a big role in that. And I don't know if I answered your question whatsoever. So.
Well, I think you might find it interesting, Tyler, when we did our first embodied topic was like in 2017 or 2018. I ended up at a table in the pub with four other people that were Nazarene adjacent, and we were all completely disembodied. So I was just wondering, have you thought about how our church background might, what is it about what we were brought up in that might add something into this equation? And I think we could broaden that a little, even if you were in a fundamentalist evangelical background, you
Sure.
know.
Yeah. No, you're right. Our tradition, I would go so far as say that the majority of Western Christianity has inherited a long theological tradition going back millennia and has always been fairly disembodied. That's not unique to just any one tradition or particular anything like that. And I would say that it really got ramped up even more during the Enlightenment, and kind of modern thinking is largely, I have air quotes there, rather than human. And to be perfectly clear, I've never met a rational human being. So I think one of the things that I have said that, what does it mean to be a person? What is like the definition of a person? This is an issue that's referred to as philosophical anthropology or theological anthropology. One of the most famous answers given to that question is by a guy named Boethius, who really kind of integrated Christian theology with Neoplatonism way, way back in the day. And his writing were central to much of what we would call the Western canon, the Western philosophical tradition. And his definition of a person is that it is an individual substance of a rational nature. And so a person is a person in as much as they are individual, completely separate from anything else, and they're rational. And I think that is a very crappy definition, because I don't think people are ever disconnected from each other. We all live in a big web of connections and relations, and people aren't rational. And the idea that we have to be rational is in fact irrational, because our cognitive processes require emotion and feeling in order to work. Anytime someone says, oh, you care more about feelings, I care more about just logic, the question then is, okay, please tell me the neurobiological distinction between thoughts and feelings. And then just wait. Because as far as I know, there isn't anything like, there's no brain test to, you can be like, oh, that's a thought and that's a feeling. Because that's not how that works.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, by virtue of that definition of, you know, a person is rational, is it then becomes really easy to say who is less of a person if they're less rational. Janelle, you're a woman.
Yeah. Am I hysterical?
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe all the backlash we see going against Taylor Swift right now for just existing as a woman in a loving relationship, and just
you know that she actually went to high school in my town at the same time I was in high school. I went to the magnet school. If I'd gone to the main school, I would have gone to school with her.
Wow.
So,
but you know, she's causing Buffalo more trauma right now, that you understand.
Yeah. I will say, from what I have heard by people who did interact with her as a teenager, is that she was not a very pleasant teenager to be around.
But many of us weren't.
Many of us were not.
And he was driven on a level that nobody will understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Myself included, I was not a very pleasant person. So, yes.
But back to your example. Yeah. If you flip, that's why one of her favorite songs is, if I was a man, then I'd be the man. I'd be the man. You sing it? I love that song. I have two daughters, and so it's very empowering. We all like to sing it in the car together. But
I have a Spotify playlist of just like girl power songs.
That's got to be in it.
It is, actually.
But if the roles were reversed, and we know this, I mean, it wouldn't, people wouldn't be having issues right now. But she has this era of time where she's powerful. It's great. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
Going back to the disembodied, it was just more of a comment and less of a question. But the idea that we look at people and we say things, even we say this to younger children. I say this to my kids, like, hey, stop crying. Like, it's okay. I'm like, I can't believe I just told my kid to stop crying. But it's like, oh, they've excessively cried for too long. It's like, in my logical mind, you have this much time to cry and then you got to get over it. What kind of damage? I mean, our parents did it to us, and their parents did it to them. I mean, hopefully we're getting better as we move along in the generations of, okay, have a good cry. Let's hug this out. But kids are way more in touch with their bodies, way more than adults.
Yeah.
And sadly, it's because adults were the ones that told them to not be in touch with their bodies. And then adolescence happens, and that complicates things more. But we could talk a lot about disembodiment through adolescence as well, I'm sure.
Yeah. I'll just say, imagine being the inner conflict that comes when you try to be trauma informed and do gentle parenting, but you're also an autistic parent who struggles with getting overstimulated through like noise pretty consistently, pretty commonly. And you're the autistic stay at home parent.
Yeah.
Of an autistic kid, that will cause some inner conflict. I can guarantee you.
Can testify to that.
Well, I'm sure. Yeah,
it's like, please stop crying. Please stop. I can't take it. You're not doing anything wrong. Just stop. Just you know. And
we all do it.
Yeah, and I took a class after he was born in seminary. It was just a little 2-hour spiritual practice, voice and identity in seminary. The preaching professor was a vocal coach. And so his specialty was in performance studies. And so he was always, even in preaching classes, we were always getting up, walking around, breathing exercises, vocal exercises, all this kind of stuff. But he had a class just on spiritual practices of just using our voices as a spiritual practice. And this was, my son was, he had to have been at least a year old. And we met outside for class. This was kind of during COVID, but basically, if everyone stood far enough away, then like we were able to like kind of justify being out on a nice day, which was nice, and practicing using our voices. And my wife had to work late, and so he had to come to class with me for a little while. And so everyone's using their voice, and the professor's talking of like we train ourselves over time to we condition our voices to fit in with society. And some of that's good. I have to be able to control my volume. But there's also this kind of negative side of we train our voices just to get along with whatever situation we find ourselves in. And while he's talking and lecturing the class, my kid is running around outside and he's just the legit, just a toddler at that point. And he's just running around yelling. And the professor was like, this is a perfect example because he is not constrained by that yet. He will be, but this is all he has to communicate. And I bet you mom and dad know what he's trying to communicate. And at that point, I actually did. And so it's just one of those things of even our voices, sometimes we can kind of get away from our voices. I grew up as in a suburb of Nashville, and I was always very sensitive to the kind of anti-Southern prejudice of having a Southern twang and sounding like I'm Cletus the slack-jawed yokel from The Simpsons or something. And so growing up, I wanted to sound as little Southern as possible. And that was born out of this kind of South anti-intellectual kind of prejudice that I've kind of had to be like, that was not like a great thing to do. And so, and I think that's another example of kind of being disembodied in a way.
Yeah, separating yourself from your environment and not letting your body participate in even where you live. Yeah, that's powerful. Well, thank you so much for coming and talking with us. This has been really powerful and I've learned a lot. Is there any last things you want to share with us, either some resources you recommend or maybe your hopes for trauma-informed spirituality?
I would say, in terms of hope, is I try. I'm not always successful, but I always try to leave room that something new can come, whatever the situation, something new can come. And that, at least for me, offers a lot of hope at times when I need it. For anybody interested in looking at trauma theology, kind of more particularly, probably the biggest name in trauma theology ish. Shelley Rambo, her book, Spirit and Trauma, Theology of Remaining, is very good. Her Resurrecting Wounds was absolutely beautiful. Serene Jones is another one of the big names out there. So thankfully, there's more and more scholars are kind of doing this line of research and theological inquiry. But those are probably the two biggest names out there these days.
We'll make sure and add some of these resources. Actually, I think there's six here from your curriculum, and then there's some other places for if people are struggling with trauma that they need to immediately get help or send this information to some friends. We'll put this online as well for you to give to your friends and colleagues.
I'll also suggest, and there's a few different places you can go online, but for looking at the ACEs study, the adverse childhood experiences that I talked about, there's a ton of information about that. A lot of it is made pretty accessible and written for a non-scholarly audience because they just want to get the information out there to as many people as possible. And so that's something that's really good too, if people are interested.
Excellent, Tyler. Really good to meet you. Janelle, always good to see you. Well, thank you everybody for listening. Thanks to Tyler and his work. Janelle, always good to see you. And if you like this episode, please share it with your friends online. We're at Brew Theology, and we are Brew_Theology on X, formerly known as Twitter. If you want to start a chapter in your community, you can email Janelle or Ryan at brewtheology.org. And until next time, peace and cheers.
Cheers.